Chapter 23. The frightful catastrophe. The trial was at hand. All the great lords and barons of Brandenburg were assembled in the Hall of Justice in the Dusel Palace. No space was left unoccupied, where there was room for a spectator to stand or sit. Conrad, clad in purple and ermine, sat in the premier's chair, and on either side sat the great judges of the realm. The old duke had sternly commanded that the trial of his daughter should proceed without favor, and then had taken to his bed broken-hearted. His days were numbered. Poor Conrad had begged, as for his very life, that he might be spared the misery of sitting in judgment upon his cousin's crime, but it did not avail. The saddest heart in all that great assemblage was in Conrad's breast. The gladdest was in his father's. For, unknown to his daughter Onrad, the old Baron Klugenstein was come, and was among the crowd of nobles, triumphant in the swelling fortunes of his house. After the heralds had made due proclamation, and the other preliminaries had followed, the venerable Lord Chief Justice said, "Prisoner, stand forth." The unhappy princess rose and stood unveiled before the vast multitude. The Lord Chief Justice continued, "Most noble lady, before the great judges of this realm it hath been charged, and proven that out of holy wedlock your grace hath given birth unto a child, and by our ancient law the penalty is death, excepting in one sole contingency, whereof his grace the acting duke, our good lord Conrad, will advertise you in his solemn sentence now, wherefore, give heed." Conrad stretched forth the reluctant scepter, and in the self-same moment the womanly heart beneath his robe yearned pityingly toward the doomed prisoner, and the tears came into his eyes. He opened his lips to speak, but the Lord Chief Justice said quickly, "Not there, your grace, not there. It is not lawful to pronounce judgment upon any of the Dusel line save from the Dusel throne." A shudder went to the heart of poor Conrad, and a tremor shook the iron frame of his old father likewise. Conrad had not been crowned, dared he profane the throne? He hesitated and turned pale with fear. But it must be done. Wondering eyes were already upon him. They would be suspicious eyes, if he hesitated longer. He ascended the throne. Presently he stretched forth the scepter again, and said, "Prisoner, in the name of our sovereign lord, Ulrich, Duke of Brandenburg, I proceed to the solemn duty that hath devolved upon me. Give heed to my words. By the ancient law of the land, except you produce the partner of your guilt, and deliver him up to the executioner, you must surely die. Embrace this opportunity, save yourself, while yet you may. Name the father of your child." A solemn hush fell upon the great court, a silence so profound that men could hear their own hearts beat. Then the princess slowly turned, with eyes gleaming with hate, and pointing her finger straight at Conrad, said, "Thou art the man." An appalling conviction of his helpless, hopeless peril struck a chill to Conrad's heart like the chill of death itself. What power on earth could save him? To disprove the charge, he must reveal that he was a woman, and for an uncrowned woman, to sit in the Dusel chair was death. At one and the same moment, he and his grim old father swooned and fell to the ground. The remainder of this thrilling and eventful story will not be found in this or any other publication, either now or at any future time. The truth is, I have got my hero or heroine into such a particularly close place that I do not see how I am ever going to get him or her out of it again, and therefore I will wash my hands of the whole business and leave that person to get out the best way that offers or else stay there. I thought it was going to be easy enough to straighten out that little difficulty, but it looks different now. Petition concerning copyright to the Honorable the Senate and House of Representatives in Congress assembled. Whereas, the Constitution guarantees equal rights to all, backed by the Declaration of Independence. And, whereas, under our laws, the right of property in real estate is perpetual, And, whereas, under our laws, the right of property in the literary result of a citizen's intellectual labor is restricted to 42 years. And, whereas, 42 years seems an exceedingly just and righteous term, and a sufficiently long one for the retention of property. Therefore, your petitioner, having the good of his country solely at heart, humbly prays that qual rights and fair and equal treatment may be meted out to all citizens, by the restriction of rights in all property, real estate included, to the beneficent term of 42 years. Then shall all men bless your honorable body and be happy. And for this will your petitioner ever pray. Mark Twain. A paragraph not added to the petition, the charming absurdity of restricting property rights in books to 42 years sticks prominently out in the fact that hardly any man's books ever live 42 years, or even the half of it. And so, for the sake of getting a shabby advantage of the heirs of about one Scott or Burns or Milton in 100 years, the lawmakers of the Reed Republic are content to leave that poor little pilfering edict upon the statute books. It is like an emperor lying in wait to rob a phoenix's nest, and waiting the necessary century to get the chance. After dinner speech, at a 4th of July gathering, in London, of Americans, Mr. Chairman and ladies and gentlemen, I thank you for the compliment which has just been tendered me, and to show my appreciation of it, I will not afflict you with many words. It is pleasant to celebrate in this peaceful way, upon this old mother soil, the anniversary of an experiment which was born of war with this same land so long ago, and wrought out to a successful issue by the devotion of our ancestors. It has taken nearly 100 years to bring the English and Americans into kindly and mutually appreciative relations, but I believe it has been accomplished at last. It was a great step when the two last misunderstandings were settled by arbitration instead of cannon. It is another great step when England adopts our sewing machines without claiming the invention as usual. It was another when they imported one of our sleeping cars the other day. And it warmed my heart more than I can tell, yesterday, when I witnessed the spectacle of an Englishman ordering an American sherry cobbler of his own free will and accord, and not only that but with a great brain, and a level head reminding the barkeeper, not to forget the strawberries. With a common origin, a common language, a common literature, a common religion and common drinks, what is longer needful to the cementing of the two nations together in a permanent bond of brotherhood? This is an age of progress, and ours is a progressive land. A great and glorious land, to a land which has developed a Washington, a Franklin, a William M. Tweed, a Longfellow, a Motley, a Jay Gould, a Samuel C. Pomeroy, a recent Congress which has never had its equal in some respects, and a United States Army which conquered 60 Indians in 8 months, by tiring them out, which is much better than uncivilized slaughter, God knows. We have a criminal jury system which is superior to any in the world, and its efficiency is only marred by the difficulty of finding 12 men every day who don't know anything and can't read. And I may observe that we have an insanity plea that would have saved Cain. I think I can say, and say with pride, that we have some legislatures that bring higher prices than any in the world. I refer with effusion to our railway system, which consents to let us live, though it might do the opposite, being our owners. It only destroyed 3,070 lives last year by collisions, and 27,260 by running over heedless and unnecessary people at crossings. The company seriously regretted the killing of these 30,000 people, and went so far as to pay for some of them voluntarily, of course, for the meanest of us would not claim that we possess a court treacherous enough to enforce a law against a railway company. But, thank heaven, the railway companies are generally disposed to do the right and kindly thing without compulsion. I know of an instance which greatly touched me at the time. After an accident, the company sent home the remains of a dear distant old relative of mine in a basket, with the remark, Please state what figure you hold him at and return the basket. Now there couldn't be anything friendlier than that. But I must not stand here and brag all night. However, you won't mind a body bragging a little about his country on the 4th of July. It is a fair and legitimate time to fly the eagle. I will say only one more word of brag, and a hopeful one. It is this. We have a form of government which gives each man a fair chance and no favor. With us, no individual is born with a right to look down upon his neighbor and hold him in contempt. Let such of us as are not dupes find our consolation in that. And we may find hope for the future in the fact that, as unhappy as is the condition of our political morality today, England has risen up out of a far fouler since the days when Charles I. ennobled courtesans and all political place was a matter of bargain and sale. There is hope for us yet.
At least the above is the speech which I was going to make, but our minister, General Schenck, presided, and after the blessing, got up and made a great long inconceivably dull harangue, and wound up by saying that inasmuch as speech-making did not seem to exhilarate the guests much, all further oratory would be dispensed with during the evening, and we could just sit and talk privately to our elbow-neighbors, and have a good sociable time. It is known that in consequence of that remark 44 perfected speeches died in the womb. The depression, the gloom, the solemnity that reigned over the banquet from that time forth will be a lasting memory with many that were there. By that one thoughtless remark, General Schenck lost 44 of the best friends he had in England. More than one said that night, "And this is the sort of person that is sent to represent us in a great sister empire."
Lionizing murderers, I had heard so much about the celebrated fortune teller Madame Dash, that I went to see her yesterday. She has a dark complexion naturally, and this effect is heightened by artificial aids which cost her nothing. She wears curls, very black ones, and I had an impression that she gave their native attractiveness a lift with rancid butter. She wears a reddish check handkerchief, cast loosely around her neck, and it was plain that her other one is slow getting back from the wash. I presume she takes snuff. At any rate, something resembling it had lodged among the hairs sprouting from her upper lip. I know she likes garlic, I knew that, as soon as she sighed. She looked at me searchingly for nearly a minute, with her black eyes, and then said, "It is enough. Come." She started down a very dark and dismal corridor, I stepping close after her. Presently she stopped, and said that, as the way was so crooked and dark, perhaps he had better get a light. But it seemed ungallant to allow a woman to put herself to so much trouble for me, and so I said, "It is not worthwhile, madam. If you will heave another sigh, I think I can follow it." So we got along all right. Arrived at her official and mysterious den, she asked me to tell her the date of my birth, the exact hour of that occurrence, and the color of my grandmother's hair. I answered as accurately as I could. Then she said, "Young man, summon your fortitude, do not tremble. I am about to reveal the past. Information concerning the future would be, in a general way, more silence. You have had much trouble, some joy, some good fortune, some bad. Your great-grandfather was hanged. That is silence. Hanged, sir. But it was not his fault. He could not help it. I am glad you do him justice. Ah, grief, rather, that the jury did. He was hanged. His star crosses yours in the 4th division, 5th sphere. Consequently you will be hanged also. In view of this cheerful, I must have silence. Yours was not, in the beginning, a criminal nature, but circumstances changed it. At the age of 9 you stole sugar. At the age of 15 you stole money. At 20 you stole horses. At 25 you committed arson. At 30, hardened in crime, you became an editor. You are now a public lecturer. Worse things are in store for you. You will be sent to Congress. Next, to the penitentiary. Finally, happiness will come again, all will be well, you will be hanged.
I was now in tears. It seemed hard enough to go to Congress, but to be hanged, this was too sad, too dreadful. The woman seemed surprised at my grief. I told her the thoughts that were in my mind. Then she comforted me. "Why, man," she said, "hold up your head, you have nothing to grieve about. Listen." In this paragraph, the fortune teller details the exact history of the Pike Brown assassination case in New Hampshire, from the succoring and saving of the stranger Pike by the Browns, to the subsequent hanging and coffining of that treacherous miscreant. She adds nothing, invents nothing, exaggerates nothing. See any New England paper for November, 1869. This Pike Brown case is selected merely as a type, to illustrate a custom that prevails, not in New Hampshire alone, but in every state in the Union. I mean the sentimental custom of visiting, petting, glorifying, and snuffling over murderers like this Pike, from the day they enter the jail under sentence of death until they swing from the gallows. The following extract from the Temple Bar 1866 reveals the fact that this custom is not confined to the United States. On December 31, 1841, a man named John Jones, a shoemaker, murdered his sweetheart, Mary Hallam, the daughter of a respectable laborer, at Mansfield, in the county of Nottingham. He was executed on March 23, 1842. He was a man of unsteady habits, and gave way to violent fits of passion. The girl declined his addresses, and he said, if he did not have her, no one else should. After he had inflicted the first wound, which was not immediately fatal, she begged for her life, but seeing him resolved, asked for time to pray. He said that he would pray for both, and... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.